We have come to Daniel chapter 6, which is the second go-around on one of the major themes of the chapters 2 through 7. We've said multiple times now that the material written in the language of the Chaldeans, which was chapters 2 through 7, are set up in a chiastic structure where you have the form of ABC and then CBA. And as is characteristic of all chiastic structures, it's the central, it's the C in this case, that's the message. And the other two lead up to it and then back away from it. The central message was chapters 4 and 5. Chapter 4 was God's confrontation, Nebuchadnezzar. I call it judgment with mercy, because he was kind of hard on him, but it was for his own awareness and final reconciliation of himself with the reality that God had revealed the truth to him. And he wrote a decree that went to the entire empire, which is a rather phenomenal fact when a king issues a decree for everybody in the empire to be aware of. And in it he praised the God of heaven and revealed all that God had been doing with him. It was kind of his personal testimony. However, as soon as we turn the chapter from chapter 4 to chapter 5, well, when you turn to chapter 5, suddenly we're at the end of Belshazzar's reign. He's the last king of the Babylonians. He's the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. And the issues are still the same. We've got a Gentile king who's arrogant and rebellious against the truth about God. He doesn't want to hear it, and he's dealt with by God. Hand starts writing on the wall, scared the living bejeebies out of him. I mean, that's where we get this knee-knocking business. And Daniel just frankly told him that he had been numbered. He'd been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And he was fixing to be destroyed, demolished. And, of course, he died that night. So I called that chapter Judgment Without Mercy. That's what I call the dark side of the mountain. If you consider chiasm as going up the mountain here, here, and here, and then you back away from it and going, but the sun's shining on this side. This is the positive side of the mountain. On the back side, where you're dealing with some of the same basic issues, the themes turn negative. As in chapter 2, you have this vision, and it's a vision of an enormous human figure. Well, when we get to chapter 7, Lord willing, next week, you're going to have the same basic information, but it's going to be presented as vicious, ravenous animals. That's the dark side. And then the judgment with mercy was Nebuchadnezzar being confronted by God. And his rebellion was stiff-necked and hard-hearted and all that. But then his grandson pulls the same stunt, and instead of bringing him to humility and recognition, God just cuts him off into the line. So this evening what we've done is we've come to chapter 6, and in the text of chapter 6, I've just given you basically the structure in terms of paragraphs and some of the major thoughts, but in the first three verses we have Darius, and by the way, I said it was either Darius or Darius, depending on which where you put the emphasis on the syllable. Well, I looked it up. The Hebrew accent is on the middle. It's Darius. Anyhow, settled that. But the Medes and the Persians had joined forces. And actually, Cyrus was in authority over Darius. And that's why at the end of the chapter it says that Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Because Daniel didn't live much longer than the event there. But anyway, he decided to set up the government of Babylon, which they had now conquered. And he divided it up into basically 120 provinces or states or however you want to call it, various geographical things. And he had set people to rule over those 120. But then he had also decided that he would put three men over the 120. And he also had decided that Daniel was going to be the first of the three, and then he was thinking about appointing him over the entire kingdom so that he was going to be over the other two. So the whole issue here in the first three verses is just the setup, because Daniel is being exalted in another Gentile empire setting. He had endured almost 70 years in the Babylonian setting and had risen to, he was sitting in the king's gate. He'd risen to basically under Nebuchadnezzar, the ruler of the Babylonian empire. He was the chief of the magicians and the sorcerers and all those guys. But the point is, Darius had set that up so that he would be basically protected. But we have this phrase in verse 3, because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. The king had decided to appoint him over the entire kingdom. And that phrase, an extraordinary spirit, shows up multiple times. King James calls it an excellent spirit, but it's in chapter 5, twice. The queen reminds Belshazzar on the night that he sees the handwriting on the wall that there's a man in his kingdom who has this extraordinary, excellent spirit. And it's not like Belshazzar didn't know that. It's just that by this point in the setting, he's so shook up he doesn't remember the things that would be helpful to remember. He had basically put Daniel out to pasture. He had his own leaders and all that kind of stuff and didn't want Daniel involved in the setup. And then in the king's response, once he called Daniel in chapter 5, verse 14, he says, I've heard of you that you have an excellent spirit. Well, in all of the cases here, this extraordinary spirit is attributed to the fact that there was a spirit of the holy gods in Daniel. And that was something that showed up early in chapter 2, because Nebuchadnezzar had made this impossible demand on his magicians and sorcerers and so forth by requiring them to tell him what he had dreamed before they gave him any kind of interpretation. Because he was pretty desperate to know the significance of this dream that he had of this huge man with a head of gold and all that. And basically, the whole point there was that it bubbled Daniel to the top, and it also made the issue, the reality that the God of the Jews was the God of heaven, and he was going to establish his kingdom upon the earth forever, and so on. And this whole business of there's a God in heaven who reveals secrets. Even Daniel said, I'm not telling you this because I've got any particular intelligence or whatever. It's not me. It's there's a God in heaven who wants you to know how the history of the world's going to run. And so he gives him this vision of this image. And we'll be going back over some of that next time. But the point is that the excellent spirit is called the spirit of the holy gods by Nebuchadnezzar and the queen. And it's recorded in chapter 4, verse 8, 9, and 18, and chapter 5, verse 11 and 14. In this case, it's just that Darius recognizes that he has an extraordinary spirit, but he recognizes far more than that, because as we see later in the record of this chapter, Darius has a strong affinity and liking for Daniel. And he says, your God will deliver you. And he says, was your God able to deliver you? So the issue here is that he's already been apprised of some of the theological issues. The thing I think that's most significant about where we're sitting here in chapter 6 is this. In a chiastic structure, you build your case from the first thing to the second thing to the third thing. In this case, is 3. And that third one is the point. And the point is that God is able to abase those that walk in pride and gives grace to the humble. That's basically the message that the Gentile nations need to know about the God of Israel. But before that, you have, in the first case, God revealing to the king how history is going to run. And in the next stage, you have the king in total rejection of that message. It is not going to run that way. And so he builds an image 90 feet tall with golden head to foot. And that's his slap in the face toward the revelation that Daniel has given him as the messenger of the King of Heaven. And that's what brought on the persecution of those who believed in the God of Heaven. And that was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. They will not bow to that thing that he has built. And they are commended for being willing to offer their lives instead of worshiping the Babylonian gods. And then you have that protective thing where Nebuchadnezzar says, I make a decree that anybody says anything bad about the God of Jesus is supposed to be torn limb from limb and all that. The point is, we have a declaration from the God of heaven that's basically a general overview of human history. Then we have a Gentile arrogant king saying that is not the way it's going to be. And it ends up with him persecuting the people who believe it is going to be that way, which happen to be the Jews. And then we have Nebuchadnezzar tackled straight on by God, where this arrogance is dealt with harshly but redemptively. And then in chapter 5, that same issue of God confronting this arrogant Gentile king, it ends up in disaster for him. He's slain that night. And now we're in chapter 6, where again, we have some of the leadership of the Medo-Persian government plotting against the one man that they can't find anything wrong with the way he does anything. And so they trick the king into making a decree that will catch him because he's faithful to God. And then he's thrown in the den of lions. So these themes of persecuting the ones who accept the truth, persecution arising because the people in authority don't accept the truth, that's a major issue. And we'll see that later in our studies when he begins to flesh out all of this revelation about how history is going to run and how the people of God are going to be persecuted off and on throughout the whole process. So, here we are with Daniel being on the verge of being made the second ruler in all the kingdom. Well, the commissioners and the satraps, all those guys that are over the 120 and the other two that are serving with Daniel as the threesome, they begin to try to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to the way he's operating in the government, and they can't find any ground of accusation or evidence of corruption because he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Now, you know from verse 4 that this is simply a way to try to get rid of the man. Now, the odd thing about that is that Daniel got where he got by trusting in the God of heaven and the revelation that the God of heaven gave him. If these men wanted to be in authority, they could copy that. But no, we're not going to copy that. We just want to get rid of that guy. And then we'll be the top dogs in the kingdom under the king. So they said, we won't find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him in regard to the law of his God. So here it comes back to the theology issue, where who are you going to believe? You going to believe the God of heaven, or are you going to just go back to your old gods and all that kind of stuff? And they know that he is loyal to this God to the point of absolute loyalty. And they know that the only way they'll ever catch him is if they come up with a way to make his loyalty to God illegal. And that's exactly what that old business about, if you hear the music, you bow down and worship my gods, is all about, forcing these Jews to abandon their confidence in God. So, they come to agreement and go to the king, and they lie to him, point blank, King Darius, live forever. That's the opening salvo of all of this conversation. All the commissioners of the kingdom, that's the three, all three of us, and the prefects and the satraps and the high officials and the governors, that's the other 120, we have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now you just stop and think about how dumb that is. Some little 2-year-old kid wants milk. Mama, can I have some milk? To the lion's den you go. You didn't ask the king. For 30 days, nobody can ask anybody anything for anything except the king. Now, it's absolutely foolish and poor Darius. I mean, when we read this, we recognize that Darius had an affinity for Daniel and the truth and the true God of heaven, but he also had the typical weakness of wanting to be recognized as super important by everybody. That's called in the scriptures the pride of life. And he's susceptible because he's human like the rest of us and he wants this. And so they come up with this thing. We're going to test the king, tempt him into signing off on a stupid decree by making him the one who will be the most important person in the kingdom without any question. Nobody can ask anything of anybody but you for 30 days. If you want to see how that works out in Israel's history, just look at Saul, first king. When they go to try to find him, he's all humility. He's, you know, I can't be. As soon as he's the king, all of a sudden it's all God. It's all about me. And I don't like this David because he's got more followers than I do, and he's more popular than me, and on and on. Well, point is, the king established the injunction, signed it, and this was according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Now here, I believe, not only here, but also in the king's attempt to get rid of it, to work Daniel out of this mess, and they come back to him and says, this is the law of the kings, the Medes and the Persians, you can't change it. You got to throw him in the lion's den. Huh? Well, I really believe that is a textual indicator of the significance of the head of gold in the next kingdom, the silver, because you're degenerating in terms of value from gold to silver, and in a very real sense, you're degenerating from total authority as a king, which in a very real sense is God's setup for the kingdom. When Jesus rules from Jerusalem, he is going to be totally absolute authority. The difference, of course, is his rule will be righteous altogether. And any human kingdom, having a despot at the top is almost always bad because the men are bad. But nonetheless, this is an indicator that's how you interpret the head of gold and the silver, and then the bronze, and then the iron and the clay. But anyhow, it diminishes the authority of the king by one rule. You can make any law you want to as a king, but as soon as you sign it, you're subject to it. Anyway, King Darius signed the document. He's caught on the euphoria of the temptation to, you know, it's kind of like with Jesus, cast yourself off of this mountain and you'll kind of compel God to honor his word, and he'll make sure everybody knows you're the most important person in all the world. The issues there are the issues of the appeal to be somebody. And as soon as it says in verse 10, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, and that implies to me that he knew what was going on. He didn't show up when the other commissioners went to the king and said, all the commissioners have said that this is a good idea. He wasn't there. But I think that part of the reason he wasn't there is because he didn't go. But anyway, as soon as he knew that the thing was signed, he entered his house. In his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God as he had been doing previously. And these men came by agreement and found him making petition and supplication before his God. So not only was Daniel a man of a habit in terms of his own spiritual life and pursuit, it was a standard procedure for him to pray 3 times a day. Not only did he do that, but everybody knew he did it. They had investigated his involvement with his God to the point where they knew where to be at what time so they could catch him. So that's what they did. And they went to the king and they said, didn't you sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition, any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast in the lion's den. The kingdom said the statement's true, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. And they answered and spoke to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you. That's the favorite phrase. If you remember back in chapter 3, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are standing out there like three sore thumbs, they go to the king and they say, those three Jews pay no attention to you. They're dissing you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, and he keeps making his petition three times a day. And as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed. Now, the King James adds the phrase, with himself, distressed with himself. And that's possible as a translation or an interpretation, no, a translation of the Hebrew, but I didn't check that out to see. But the fact is, it's very possible that his distress was with himself. Oh man, what kind of fool have I been? That kind of reaction. And he set his mind on delivering Daniel, and even until sunset he kept exerting himself to rescue him. And then these men came by agreement to the king and said, recognize, O king, it's a law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. Now here, these plotters have signed their own death warrant. Even if Daniel had been eaten by the lions, I think Darius would have been sufficiently irritated with at least the two commissioners to have remove them from authority, because this is not the way you get on the good side of king. Force him and then remind him that he's under force. I mean, it's just dumb. It's kind of like in chapter 2. King, you got no business telling us that we need to tell you what you dreamed and then what it means, because no king's ever done that before and you don't have any... I mean, you wouldn't get on the king's bad side. You talk to him like that. Anyway, they remind him, and the king gives orders, and Daniel's brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. Now, a couple of things in this verse that I think are significant. To cast him into the lion's den implies that the den is below ground, or at least it's below the entry point, because they throw him in. And then when they throw these guys and their families in a little bit later, it says that they broke all their bones before they ever hit the ground. So apparently there's a hole at the top where you can put something in or throw them their food or whatever, but it's a little bit of a drop down there, and that way I guess the lions can't get out when you open up the opening. The second thing that I find interesting is that he says your God whom you constantly serve will himself deliver you, because it says in verse 18, the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him, and the king rose at dawn of the next day and went in haste, and when he came near the den, he cried out in a troubled or lamentable, I like the King James, lamentable voice. The king spoke and said, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God been able to deliver you? He told Daniel, your God will deliver you, but this is just talk. And I really feel like that this issue of this, he's attempting to get Daniel, to encourage Daniel, but he's also hoping against hope that his own stupidity won't cause the death of this man that he values highly. And when we get in positions like that, we revert to religious talk real quick. Oh, your God will do this. Stone was brought, laid over the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet ring. And then he did one more thing. He required his nobles to seal it too with their signet, so that nothing might be changed. And later they couldn't come back and say, somebody let him out. That thing's sealed with all their seals, their signet rings. And I think it's commendable of the king that he's in such a state of mind in verse 18 and 19 and 20, because it indicates that in spite of his egotistical foolishness, he still has a conscience. He still has a sensitivity of what really is the wrong here. He's the one who was wrong, not Daniel. And it's eating his lunch. He can't sleep. He doesn't want anybody entertaining him. He doesn't want to eat. And as soon as the day breaks, he goes in haste. I wondered when I read that and was thinking about it, why being thrown in the lion's den would be limited to just an overnighter. I mean, why didn't they throw him in there and then get him back out? Or why didn't they leave him in there for a week? Apparently, the king felt like overnight will be enough. If he's still alive in the morning, we're getting him out of there. He says, as your God whom you constantly serve. Now, we need to be as clear as we can be about this issue of cause and effect. In our natural humanity, we always attribute the way God treats us to the way we act. We always do. This is why legalism has always been a pervasive force in the church as early as Galatians. Well, it was from the beginning. There was a group in the church in Jerusalem that were insisting that you had to become a Jew and be circumcised and all that. And even when you hear somebody preach on the fact that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, it's always twisted to say, well, Noah was a godly man, so God made special arrangements for him. That's not what grace is. Grace is treating somebody well in spite of what they deserve to have. It's the opposite of justice. And so here, the king reveals his legalism by saying, you're so faithful to your God. Surely, surely, surely he would reward you with your, you know. And that's basically the religion of the Babylonians. That's the only reason they bowed to any gods, is because they wanted some favors and they figured they could get them if they behaved a certain way. And it's carried down through humanity all the way to this present day. We still think that way. What's the first thing most believers ask when everything goes south? What did I do wrong? And in fact, that song that came out here years ago, What Have I Ever Done to Deserve Even One of the Blessings You've Shown? Absolutely nothing. Or, you know, that Butterfly Kisses, where I must have done something right to get all these blessings.
That was in the Sound of Music, too.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good.
Absolutely. It's ingrained in us. It's as bad as the pride of life. It's that same performance reward mindset. I just recognize that the problems of humanity have been here for a long time. They're still here, and that's pervasive. You have to consciously reject the legal thinking, especially when you go to God. But anyway, the king said that. You constantly serve. Has he been able to deliver you? And Daniel said, O king, live forever. There you go again. My God sent his angel, shut the lion's mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him. I was innocent. It wasn't I've lived such a good life. It's this charge was a trumped up thing. I was innocent. And also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. So the king was very pleased, and he gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. And so he was taken up, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. No injury found on him is just exactly like chapter 3, where even the smell of smoke wasn't on their garments. So we have these parallels between these two paragraphs, chapters. Chapters 3 and 6 are both dealing with the ungodly persecuting the godly, and the godly trusting God and he acting on their behalf. And the thing that you have to remember is Habakkuk 2:4. Because God doesn't deliver people who trust in Him these days. Lots of times. But He had told Habakkuk to tell the Judeans before Babylon came, just a year or two before they came, He had told them that if they were justified by faith, they would live. And in that context, that was the promise of physical life through the Babylonian aggressions and all that. And that's why Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said in chapter 3, our God will deliver us. And here, it's not, and there it wasn't just talk. In the king's mouth, it was just talk. Your God will deliver you. Oh, he was hoping. He was hoping against hope. But in verse 24, he got even. They gave orders and brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel. Not only had they lied to the king, but they had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them and their children and their wives into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. So then Darius mimics Nebuchadnezzar 25. He writes a decree to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who are living in all the land. So here we have two records of two Oriental potentates, masters of a huge empire, writing a declaration to everybody in the kingdom and making a declaration of some sort. And so Darius says, I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. Now, there are echoes in this statement. His kingdom is one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. There are clear echoes there to the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Because a stone cut out of the mountain pulverizes the image and turns it into dust, and it blows away, and the stone swells into a great mountain, fills the whole earth, and there's no end to his reign or dominion. And that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar rebelled against. So we're having all these interactions or things that come back on us after we've read earlier, and then there's comment again. And I believe that that's one reason we can have some confidence in our interpretation of the prophecies, because there are these hints all along the way. This God delivers, rescues, performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions.